It's live.
Hi, everybody. How are you doing? Welcome back to the Morality of Everyday Things. Sorry for the short, extended break between Christmas and then a trip. Actually, no, we recorded after Christmas.
We recorded since Christmas. We went to Mexico. This is the real reason.
Sí. Y ahora puedo hablar un poco español.
Sí. And the rest of the podcast is going to be in Spanish as well. So.
Sí. Mi español no es, how do you say good enough?
Bueno. No, I don't know.
I don't know how to say enough. Jesus, that's not making my point. Pero no puedo hablar de filosofía en español yet, todavía.
In English. Yeah, welcome back. Today's episode is going to be on quite a big question. God a good thing?
Yeah, actually, for those, set the scene, Jacob and I were riding through the mountains of Oaxaca in the back of a very windy bus. And
it was a really uncomfortable ride in many ways. But then also,
it was quite nice. It was beautiful.
Yeah, it started uncomfortable. It was sweaty.
Oh, yeah. And it was very full. But then fortunately, people got out before we really got into the mountains. Before taking mushrooms, we said, is God a good thing? No, we were discussing topics and a couple things. One, we're going to start doing slightly longer episodes and then breaking them into parts. This is partially because it lets us flesh out topics more and partially because it means that we don't have to record quite as often, which
sounds lazy, selfish. But, it's all about efficiency.
Yeah, that means that we can break problems down a bit more, and it's interesting. We bring in more perspectives.
And the episodes will be more sort of listenable for you guys.
Yes. Before we get into it, as always, thank you to everyone who has reviewed us. Interestingly, on Spotify, first of all, we're just coming up to 1.5K followers. If you listen to the podcast or this is your first episode and you like it, please do follow on Spotify. Easiest way to see new episodes. We have 37 five-star ratings so far on the Spotify platform. And that's genuinely not from like manufacturing.
We haven't gotten around to that apart from on here.
Yeah, apart from on here, which, you know, I suppose is genuine. So if you are enjoying it, do leave a review on Spotify. If you're on an iPhone, leave a review on Apple Podcasts. That'd be really helpful. And if you enjoy it, share it with a friend. Honestly, it's the easiest way for it to grow.
We're doing this really because we enjoy it. It's a passion project. It's fun.
We like to
debate things and we like to do things that make you think. So
yes. Okay. So firstly, there's going to be three parts, like we said. First one, reasons to believe in God. So this will be looking at some of the classic philosophical arguments that people make as to why one should believe in God. The second part will be whether God is actually a useful thing.
Yeah. Whether religion and God in particular has been good for society. Yeah. Beneficial.
Yeah. The overall goods and bads. So like the concept of God, has that been a positive thing? And we'll kind of discuss some of the bads and goods and bring in some classic philosophical perspectives. And then finally, so I'm just trying to get the headline.
Part three is about authority, right?
Yes, the part three will be interesting. Part three will be looking at justification for the moral authority of God. So there's some classic arguments in whether God exists or not. Why would it be a moral person to listen to? Like, where does his moral authority come from? So let's begin. Part one, reasons to believe in God.
Okay, let's start off with a question of which God are we talking about?
Yeah, it's always helpful to clarify this. I think lots of the arguments that we're going to look at are arguments that really rely on or entail quite a specific conception of God that I think is in reality very biased towards both our perspectives or our familiar concept of God, and also I would say probably the conception that's most common to both our main listener base but
mainly the Abrahamic religion.
Is it true that would basically make it the most common in the world?
Between Christianity, Judaism, and Islam.
Yeah, would that collectively encompass most conceptions of God?
I think so, statistically.
I mean,
there are major way more.
Yeah, like, yeah.
So, I mean,
you have polytheistic things like Hinduism. And then also, you have like conceptions of God and gods whereby they're not necessarily, even if it's monotheistic or not, or, you know, in many cases it's not, maybe the gods are kind of flawed or not all powerful rather than just
gods that have changed through time. I mean, you look at the Greek gods and they were sort of almost human in some of their flaws, right?
Yeah, exactly. They certainly
proud
were,
and vengeful and jealous.
Exactly. And they were actually the center of most of their pieces. But yes, we'll be focusing on a certain conception of God.
Yeah. So for the most part, like you're saying, this will be the god of theism. And generally, there are like three characteristics that are given to this god. God is omniscient, which means all-knowing.
Has a big white beard.
Omnibenevolent, which is all-loving. And omnipotent, which means all-powerful. And it's funny, actually, just in reference to that, because we've done an episode on the big guy with the beard in the sky before.
Yeah.
That was on Santa Claus.
Yes. But really, if you think about that. So not all of the arguments that give reasons to believe in God necessarily mean that we have to conceive of a god of this nature. But particularly in a Western context, if you asked a random person in the US, like, describe God, you know, assuming that they're not like a total idiot who would literally say, I don't know, guy with a beard in the sky, you know, if they're going to give like some specific traits of God, I think these are the kind of things that they would be pointing out.
This they may, of course, describe Morgan Freeman from Bruce Almighty.
Kind of like a salt and pepper look between the hair and the beard. But sorry, go on.
The reason for that, I suppose, is because throughout Western philosophy, people have made a lot of appeals to debating religion and particularly God. And those are the things we're going to come to in a second.
Yep.
But yeah, there are plenty of arguments that try and prove that God exists and that therefore you should believe in him. They often seek to prove that God would be necessary. That is, if the argument withstands criticism, it would basically be impossible that God doesn't exist. So it's like an appeal to logic and reason to prove the existence of God.
And importantly, I think certainly in this first one we'll discuss, which is the classic ontological argument, it really hinges on the specific definition that we gave earlier, omnipotent, particularly omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent.
Just to give you a flavor of the kind of arguments that are coming up, we're going to look at the ontological argument, Pascal's wager, the problem of evil, that's quite a big one. Faith and reason, Kierkegaard, and I think, we're leaving Nietzsche for next episode, aren't we? Mm. Or is Nietzsche in this one?
I think Nietzsche's for next episode, yeah.
Lovely.
Okay. More about the use of God.
Yeah. But let's start with the ontological argument. I really like this one, or at least I think it's quite fun.
I think it's one of those things where like it kind of shows how you can... Are you familiar with rhetoric in the classical Greek sense?
Mm-hmm.
Rhetoric in ancient Greece was a bit like law today, right? Where it was like the art of winning arguments rather than the art of being right.
Yeah. It's about framing in some respect, right?
Yeah. 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 So, I mean, we're going to talk through this ontological argument, and I think anyone with any sense is going to say, well, obviously that's bullshit.
It's persuasive on the surface, but yeah.
Yeah.
There's a way to cut through it, right?
Yeah. So, anyway, it's potentially one of the best or worst arguments for the existence of God. It's ontological. So, ontology meaning a study of concepts like being and existence. Mm-hmm. So related to deontology. This is because the structure...
Oh, wait, I actually never made that connection.
I can't say what the day adds to deontology. I mean, if it's related to being and existence, and it sounds so similar. This is because the structure of the argument relies on nothing from experience, right? Basically, we're saying this is an argument that's based purely on the definition of God, not on some reliance on evidence of life that we've experienced. So for example, relying on actual evidence rather than definitional stuff would be saying something like, oh, look at the human eye, it's so complex. How could that not be designed?
Yeah. Right?
And obviously the answer to that is evolution. like billions of years natural selection. So here's another ontological argument. All bachelors are single, right? I don't need to go out and check whether bachelors are single. It's definitional.
Yeah.
Right?
So what you're saying there is it's deductive rather than inductive, right? If you were looking at evidence, developing that evidence into like a proof, you'd be making an inductive claim. But if it's deductive, you can just purely use logic based on the premises.
Yeah.
And in this case, the premise is the definition.
Yeah. So another good example, all triangles are three-sided.
Yeah.
Which, it's by definition of a triangle, that statement is true.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. So the ontological argument has various different conceptions. In its original conception by Anselm, it goes something like the following. One, God is defined as a being than which nothing greater can be conceived, the greatest of all beings.
He's so great. Sounds like Trump. It actually sounds like how Trump would embody himself. I am the greatest of all beings. Nothing greater can be conceived.
Two, if you agree, then you can think of God as the greatest being, at least in your mind. Three, there are two possibilities for any object. Either an object can exist only in the mind, or it can exist both in the mind and in reality. Four, if God only exists in the mind, then a greater God can be thought of, i.e. one that also exists in reality. Therefore, five, as God is the greatest being, he must exist in reality as well as in the mind.
Right, okay. So this first appearance seems logically like appealing, right? But it seems that it's not possible for God to not exist in reality in addition to the mind. By definition, God would not be the greatest being if he didn't exist. And so God must exist when you accept this definition. However, okay, basically he set out five steps there, right?
Yeah.
And so the obvious way to say that you don't agree with the conclusion is to specify which of the five steps you don't agree with, right? Mm-hmm. One is purely definitional, right? Like, yeah. So yeah, that's fine. Two, if you agree, then you can think of God as the greatest being, at least in your mind. I don't agree. The premise number two is, do you agree that God exists? So it's not really solved the problem. And then four, by the way, I mean, worth noting, these are arguments of God's existence. The overall topic is whether God's a good thing. We're just starting from the argument of existence.
Yeah.
The other one that I had an issue with reading through it was four. If God only exists in the mind, then a greater one can be thought of one that exists in reality. Why is existence in reality a trait of something that is greater than something that exists in the mind? Love exists in the mind.
Mm.
You know, I mean, like, there are examples of that. I mean, my conception of self is something that only exists in my mind. How does the existence of something in, or say, for example, I can imagine the idea of, I don't know, a yellow chair. How is that greater than my conception of a yellow chair, right? It's potentially neutral, the difference.
That's like, interesting. That wasn't a line of argument I thought you'd go now, but I take your point.
Like, why does that make something greater?
I suppose it's the argument that if you can think of this being that's all great and omnipotent and powerful, but it's only a figment of your imagination, he would be better if he exists. I know I've just sort of restated the premise.
Yeah.
But
I mean, it doesn't, you don't really give a reason as to why, right?
You know, let's take a different
example. Just taking the premise that existence is better than non-existence.
Yeah, imagine a perfect holiday and existing in your mind. Going on that perfect holiday is better than just imagining it, right?
I might enjoy it more, but maybe the imaginary holiday is greater than the real holiday.
Well, that's true.
One of the things that, you know, one of the arguments that would be given around God, like any God that existed, you could think of a way to make it better. And so it's not the best.
Yeah. I mean, a really interesting and probably the most famous criticism of this argument that kind of tears it down is to use an argument by analogy to say that this method could be used to prove the existence of anything, which is kind of what you're saying. You're questioning the fact that is existence necessarily better than something imaginary? But if you accept that as true, you can take this guy called Guanillo, mm-hmm. his argument. He said, imagine the perfect island, although in practice, you can imagine the perfect anything, whatever resonates with you, listeners. Imagine the perfect bottle of wine. Imagine perfect football match. Imagine whatever it is.
I see it. Charlton.
I was literally thinking Charlton's player fighting against Sunderland.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
But I don't think that's necessarily as relatable. Let's go with the perfect bottle of wine. That's quite a fun one.
Yeah. Or, you know, island, paradise, holiday, whatever.
Sure. The perfect island, paradise, holiday, bottle of wine is one that of which no greater such thing can be conceived. It's the greatest. It's the best bottle of wine mm-hmm. ever. You can think that it exists at least in the mind because you can imagine it. It can either exist in the mind or exist in the mind and reality. Therefore, if it exists only in the mind, a greater one can be conceived of, which also exists.
I mean, you've basically just done Control F, Control H, God for wine, island, whatever
exactly.
You want. And it's really just hitting at the thing that I've said, which is that the assumption that something existing versus not makes it better, one, and mm-hmm. two, defining something as
the best
doesn't simply bring it into existence, right?
Like, yeah.
I could imagine the perfect partner, right? Mm-hmm. Like, just the ability to imagine that, define them as you know, the best, and then thinking, well, the best partner would exist, and therefore they exist.
So therefore they must exist. There must be somewhere. Where are you?
Somewhere in my 500 Hinge matches, she's bound to be hiding.
Nice flex.
No, that's just classic. That's classic match and never talk.
Yeah, but it's true. And I mean, it's a great way to reduce the argument to something ridiculous.
Yeah, no, it proves how it's one of those things that sounds logically appealing, but you know, once you give it a little bit of deeper thought, you realize it's nonsense, which is why I made that reference to ancient Greek rhetoric. It's a lot of it is that kind of thing where, like, on the surface it sounds logically appealing, but just takes a little bit of digging to realize all that's happened is you've just assumed a crappy premise.
Yeah.
So I mean, a really good example of this is basically anything that Plato's written, where Socrates said something ridiculous, and then because Plato's writing the book, he has the other person say, okay, we can take that as a premise.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, clearly that's an unreasonable premise. That's why we're building up a ridiculous argument. I don't think that's necessarily a terrible thing. A lot of his work is like explorative, right? Mm. And some of these premises, you know, need to be allowed for a bit to come to interesting overall ideas. But the reason that they're not overall actually sound ideas is because we're accepting premises like that, which we shouldn't.
And you can see strongly that this really relies on that sort of Western theistic impression of God being perfect or powerful. And that's true because linked to the ancient Greeks, their gods weren't necessarily that, as we said. They were flawed. So.
Yes. And it's interesting. Like, I think a lot of arguments, discussion around God, kind of, certainly when you're doing these super logical ones and rational, you kind of come to these paradoxes of, you know, these paradoxes around terms like omnipotent, right? Mm. It's the kind of classic, like, what happens when the unstoppable force hits the immovable object.
It is, right? Like, it's a sort of definitional paradox.
Yeah. Right? The only thing it proves is that there probably is, I'm saying probably, I'm quite assured, there is nothing that's omnipotent because, you know, definitionally it's hard. hard to achieve that.
Yeah, it sort of becomes more semantic, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Let's move on to the next argument. This is another fun one. I like this.
Yeah. So this is an argument for believing in God, right?
Yeah. Yep. Pascal's wager. And as you say, this works a little bit differently because the aim of the last God argument was to say it was to prove that God must exist, whereas this one is more aimed at providing a reason that a person should believe in God. And to be fair, you could say proving the existence of God might therefore make people believe, because it's like, well, he definitely exists.
Yeah.
Therefore, I believe in him.
At like a high level, they both try to achieve the same thing. They're just taking different routes, right?
Yeah.
Pascal is persuasive, whereas the other one is trying to be like, well, it's just right.
Yeah.
Anyway, the argument here is that it's a better bet. It's a wiser gamble to believe in God than not.
And that's why it's called the wager.
Yes. This is because the price of not believing in God, if he does not exist, is infinitely bad, i.e. an eternity in hell. If you believe in God, but he doesn't exist, then that's a finite loss. You've wasted some time in church and then you die and you don't even, you know, that's it. Like, that's all you've lost. You know, maybe you've done some things differently, but it's not that bad a loss for you. And in fact, this is something we'll cover in the next episode. Maybe generally adhering to the idea that a God exists could even be a kind of good thing, mm-hmm. right? It might be emotionally beneficial to you. And it also might be a general good moral guide. You know, mm-hmm. would I do that? There's a man in the sky watching me. But if you don't believe in God and he doesn't exist, then, you know, there's a small finite gain. Maybe there's some things you would have done that otherwise you wouldn't have. Maybe you just saved the time that you spent in church. Most importantly, though, this is the big one. If you do believe in God and he does exist, there's an infinite gain.
Woo! Big win.
I know. Eternity in heaven. Thus, it is a better wager. It's basically saying, let me give an analogy.
Well, it's like a game tree, right? And if you imagine in game theory, you've got two strands, believe in God, don't believe in God. And then you've got the next layer is God exists, God doesn't exist.
Yeah.
You can literally plot the paths. And the funny thing is, obviously, in one strand, you don't believe in God, but he does exist.
Yeah.
You've got an eternity in hell, and that's really bad. That's like minus infinity.
Put it like this. It's like if someone offers you a wager and they say, hey, look, if you win, then I'll give you £10 million.
Mm-hmm.
If you lose, I'll kill you.
Yeah.
Right? And the cost of the wager is £1. Mm-hmm. Right? Most people would say you don't even need to know what the probabilities are. It's worth paying the £1.
Wait, why?
Because the cost of the £1 is so small relative to either winning £10 million or being killed.
Sorry, right? You're saying you pay the pound not to take the... No. You're not paying to be killed here, right?
No, sorry. if you give me a pound, there's a chance that you'll have...
You'll have 10 million.
10 million.
If you don't give me the pound,
there's a chance I'll kill you.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And the argument is basically, you don't know what the probabilities are, but it doesn't matter because the cost of £1 is so small relative to the potential benefit and potential gain.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good way of framing infinity.
Yeah, he's basically saying, I'd rather care that I don't know the probabilities. I'd rather guarantee losing a pound.
Yeah.
Right? Because if you pay the pound, the worst case scenario is you've lost a pound.
It's true.
It's actually basically an example of loss aversion.
Yeah. Kahneman would love this.
Yeah.
And I think what's funny is I presented this to people who are like really sort of people I consider really smart. And actually, by and large, people are like, yeah, actually, this makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I mean, when you frame it the way that I've just said, right?
Yeah.
£1 to take a bet where you might win a thingy, and if you don't win 10 million, and if you don't pay the pound, you might die.
It sounds
definitely in that analogy
dauntingly compelling.
Yeah, it's like, of course I'd pay a pound.
Yeah,
but I think
let's take this apart because it falls apart in quite a lot of interesting ways. And mostly it falls apart definitionally because I mean, one, it's not necessarily a guarantee. Like faith is something we've kind of defined here, but there's a big argument that you don't wake up and just decide to bet on God.
Yeah, or certainly that's not true belief or you know some sort of argument.
Does God care about that? Like, is there any guarantee that God cares about you going to worship him? Like,
yes, I think the big thing is that, and this is something that, for example, no offense to those listening, I've always found about Catholicism so confusing, or certainly about a lot of religious people. This is something that we'll discuss, but like, it's very much the kind of arc of
the
going through. No. It's kind of the whole like, going through the motions, but not really understanding the point of the belief, right?
The motions become quite sort of culturally entrenched. But you're right. Like, there's no, there seems to be no sort of proof that that's the method needed to achieve.
Well, and I mean, more specifically, this idea that like, say, for example, Catholics, they're like, as long as I confess my sins, like, you know, I'm good with God. And it's like, technically, but like, I think the point is that you should actually feel bad and that you should try and avoid doing the sins.
Yeah.
Whereas some people kind of take it more the other way, where it's like, no, as long as I accept God and say and confess my sins, it's all good, right? You're kind of missing the point in between. And, you know, there's kind of this sense of like, certainly the one that most people would make reasonably, and we'll come to the whole idea of like the problem of evil or good and evil and all that. But like, it's kind of this sense of like, well, as long as I live as a good person, if God is great and kind and benevolent, and I've lived a good life, you know, and I die and then I'm to find out that he exists, like, surely a kind God would rather that I was, you know, a good person who wasn't sure whether to believe rather than someone who, you know, went through the motions, but was basically taking a bet and didn't actually care, had no faith.
And that's the big thing, isn't it? That's the major criticism of Pascal, is that God wouldn't necessarily, like, why would God necessarily approve of you just being so calculating?
Yeah. And this, again, it's going to be a big theme in the next episode, I think. The difference between, and it's similar to laws, like understanding laws as writ or understanding laws as intended, right? The classic analogy.
The letter or the spirit.
Yeah. Right? This is, I think the classic analogy, and this really annoys me, is when, like, to give a couple examples, it's when you have Catholic teenagers who have anal sex. Like, it's like, I personally don't agree with the idea of abstinence, but if you're espousing abstinence, then but you're having anal sex to get around the rules, like, I think you're missing the point. And then, you know, another example, like, is like Muslim friends of mine who are like, can't drink, that's haram, but smoke weed. And and again, it's like, you know, like, I think you are missing the point of the thing that you're espousing.
Well, yeah, presumably there the idea is that drugs cloud your judgment, right?
Yeah. So like, okay, fine, maybe they didn't have the foresight to include that in the list of things at the time of writing the biblical texts or the religious text, but like, clearly you're missing the spirit of this thing.
Yeah. So that was Pascal's wager. That's quite a fun one. Now we come on to quite a heavy one, which this, is the problem
is actually
of evil.
The inverse. So the other two were reasons to believe in God, and this is a classical reason not to believe in God.
Exactly.
So the problem of evil was actually first put forward by Epicurus. Something along the lines of, basically definitional again, like, okay, if God is omnipotent and omnibenevolent, then, you know, either he chooses to allow evil, in which case he's not, you know, all loving,
benevolent,
or he can't stop evil existing, which means he's not omnibenevolent.
Omnipotent.
Right? Omnipotent, sorry.
Yeah.
The only problem with that argument is that, like, that would disprove his omnipotence or omnibenevolence. That doesn't disprove his existence or whether we should worship him. Like, worship of him is not necessarily conditional on those two definitional points being correct, right?
Yeah.
But anyway, we'll talk through the whole argument.
It's an interesting point, though, isn't it? Because I think it's, as we said at the beginning, those are the three premises that are standardly accepted for the definition of God. Like, he's all loving, he's all powerful, and he's all knowing. But as you say, I mean, if evil exists, he's either not all loving or he can't stop it, in which case he's not all powerful.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, we kind of jumped in and said, oh, Epicurus puts this forward, blah, blah, blah. To spell it out, basically, the problem of evil is evil exists. How is that compatible with the existence of God? Is that proof that God doesn't exist? And like we said, this is largely contingent on an understanding of God that is reliant on these definitional terms.
Yeah. But it's also, I mean, it seems to be a strong case. And there's lots of people who basically kind of pick up on this as their main reason for not being religious. There's a nice quote from the Brothers Karamazov.
Oh, yeah. So Brothers Karamazov is a book by Dostoevsky, which is both like a novel and somewhat philosophical, quite philosophical. I think like quite a few philosophers name it as one of their favorite books and most influential books. And basically there are brothers who represent a spectrum of, there's three brothers that represent a spectrum of the religious beliefs. Like one is a priest, so belief. One is a member of the intellectual elite who writes an essay criticizing the belief in God, quite famously. And the third one is someone who kind of intuitively believes in God, but is still a bit of a sensualist and, you know, commits sins, sins of lust. And the whole book is about whether or not he committed a murder. That we can kind of see him as the kind of, we see the two younger brothers as these ideals, and we see the third one more as like ourselves.
The human.
The real human, right? But the point is that the younger brother is a priest and the middle brother, who's the intellectual, have an argument. And basically he brings forward this problem of evil argument and actually refers to genuine accounts. Dostoevsky used actual accounts from actual newspapers of children being raped and tortured by adults, etc. And kind of puts forward like basically the problem of evil, but then kind of takes it a step further and says, actually, even if God exists, if this is the world that he considers to be acceptable, I actually want nothing to do with him. So the actual quote is, it's not that I don't accept God. I just most respectfully return him the ticket. I want no part in heaven created by a man who allows this. Or sorry, that was sexist.
Why was going about women?
That's kind of a common Western conception of the problem. It's certainly the famous case of it.
It's a powerful argument, right? And I mean, you've listed some examples of evil there. There are plenty other things anyone can point to in their own lives of stuff that stuff that seems to go wrong and affect sort of innocent people. It doesn't even seem to be particularly karmic, right? It's not like someone does something bad and they get punished. It's like kids are born with horrible birth defects. You know, my mum used to volunteer at Great Ormond Street Hospital, which is one of the big ones in London where kids with like really challenging special diseases go, and they've got like expert help, but there's some stuff you see, it's like, my God, this is really like,
So overall, basically this argument would say, logically, if evil exists, maybe we can't accept that God is, you know, as defined, omnipotent, omnibenevolent, omniscient. However, we can also then take it that little step further where we say, not only might God not exist, but if God exists, maybe the form that he's in doesn't merit worship, which is that kind of argument of the guy from Brothers Karamazov. So how do people kind of generally address this?
Yeah, it's quite a big challenge to religions in general, right? Or theistic thinkers. Yeah.
So an appeal that some people will make will be to human free will as a way of kind of reconciling the existence of evil and the existence of God. It was originally put forward by Leibniz, but it's also argued by Plantinga. Quickly before we go into that, I feel like this is another one where like actually the premise is wrong, right? Because whilst the conception of human free will fits well into the Abrahamic like tradition of gods and human, it suits the story of Garden of Eden, right?
Yeah, and it suits the story of Abraham and his son, where God's like, sacrifice him, and he's like, okay, and then
that's a different point.
Sorry, I realize I'm
That's actually a good example of
that's a good example of doing exactly what God tells you.
It doesn't make it more,
and God seems to like that. So
yeah, interesting. But yeah, so no, I'm just saying, they carve out this like, but it's because of human free will, right?
Yeah, original sin.
Well, I'm kind of like, you've specified the thing, but that still means he's not omnipotent. You've just specified a way in which he's not omnipotent. Or chooses not to be omnipotent. Like, it doesn't really solve the problem. Like, it's a bit like saying, I don't know, if my toddler's doing something crappy, you know, it's a bit like saying, but he's a toddler and he doesn't know better or whatever. And it's like, well, yes, but you're an adult and that doesn't absolve you from then like stopping your toddler doing crappy things, right?
Yeah, it sort of seems to cast God more in the role of like a game designer.
Yeah.
Like he's sort of designed the world and sort of just set things in motion and been like, cool, you guys do you.
Yeah, but anyway, sorry. To carry on with the actual response, based on that Leibniz put forward with human free will, basic response is that because we have free will and God thought that giving us free will would be a good thing, this means that humans sometimes make mistakes and choose evil. It is thus the product of humans having free will, which means that evil exists in the world. For it is better that humans have free will and there be some evil as a product of them sometimes choosing to do bad things than humans not being free.
Which certainly fits the religious original sin kind of thing, right? It certainly might work for some of the big problems. It seems plausible to think that human free will might after all be responsible for things like war, things like poverty. It's the way we've sort of designed societal systems. This might even have the upshot of explaining some natural evils, but I find it harder to see this. This one links. For example, quote, the intensity, frequency, and duration of North Atlantic hurricanes have all increased since the 80s. And that seems to be a result of global warming. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, things like volcanic eruptions, stuff like that, earthquakes.
Yeah, it doesn't explain those.
Yeah.
People being born with terrible diseases, like you said. And kind of like I mentioned, it might solve the logical problem of evil, the inconsistency between the divine attributes of God and the presence of evil. But it doesn't really solve the problem that there is a bunch of evil and he's not doing anything about it.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah, there's a guy called Rao who has a good example of this, which is that if we imagine that there is a deer in the forest who dies a slow and painful death as a result of a forest fire, which is sad, and no one ever finds this deer, it seems to be a case of complete unnecessary evil in the world.
Yep.
Sad image.
Yeah. Yeah, and there are plenty of instances like that. The point about the evidential problem of evil is that if there has to be some evil in the world in order for humans to have free will, then that doesn't explain all instances of evil. Oh, that's a slightly different point actually to one I was making, whereby, you know, just because you've like descriptively explained why it exists, that doesn't explain why God wouldn't step in and change it.
Mm.
But no, okay, so this is actually the argument that some of it is explained but not all of it. Some of it is still unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
That's your argument around volcanoes, children with terrible diseases, which just aren't the result of free will.
Yeah, it both does not seem the case that this kind of suffering is a product of human free will or is necessary in order that humans have free will. So, like, yeah, there's still unexplained evil. That's exactly what you said.
Yeah, yeah. And then even then, like I said, the free will evil, you know, like there's a balance. Like, is that really worth it? Also, one other conception, perhaps to the benefit of this. Okay, humans are relativistic creatures, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, we could see an argument that this is twofold. One, if humans are relativistic, maybe no matter how perfect the world God made for us was, we would see some evil in it. But really, actually, it wouldn't be that evil on the scale of evil. It's just that we're seeing things relativistically.
Mm.
But then you can also make the argument that, like, if God is omnipotent and omnibenevolent, why does he give us the capacity to, why does he make us relativistic so that we necessarily see evil? That's one.
Cool.
And then I think another point that's interesting just went away from my head.
There's this one here is that God could make us so that we have free will, but we can always freely choose only the good, which actually I think that seems to be an oxymoron because it's like
it's not
you have free will, but you can only choose good things.
Yeah.
Which in the game designer sort of conception doesn't seem impossible.
Well, I mean, we have free will, but also have instilled naturally a strong sense of morality. So mm-hmm. that maybe that's not that far off how we actually are made.
Maybe that definition, I think the thing there is it wouldn't make us significantly free. And that's a quote from Plantinga. So
another classic argument would be like, okay, we perceive evil, but you know, the whole God works in mysterious ways argument. And it's just that we don't have the omniscience to see far enough into the future how yes. this is a necessary evil to achieve some good in the mid to long term.
Yeah, that's a classic quote of religion, right? God yeah. works in mysterious ways to explain the fact that you might not see or understand the reason for something now.
Exactly. But. And then you know, certainly the most religiously devout will try and find the good in anything as an explanation for why God did that horrible thing to them. You know, God put this challenge before me to make me a better person. And actually that was necessary for me to achieve X, Y, Z later in my life.
Yeah. And I mean, to be fair, that can be a really positive way of living your life in some respect, because it sort of forces you to be optimistic. But you don't need God.
No. That's, it's one of those things where, again, coming to it in the next episode, you know, maybe a good reason for the existence of God, a quote-unquote God, so not him literally existing, but him as a concept existing in our society, is that it does encourage people to think that way. Mm-hmm. And it's generally beneficial for people to think that way. But as you say, it's not necessary for that to be the reason. Like, you could also just have like a humanistic understanding that like, okay, crappy things happen in life. Being stoic is like the only way of dealing with it. And in the long run, that's better.
Change the things you can't accept. Accept the things you cannot change.
Rock and roll.
That's the problem of evil. The next key point is faith versus reason. So with all the arguments above, they suppose that there's an incompatibility between like the success of the arguments we've made and the concept of faith, which we haven't really talked about yet.
Yeah. Whether these arguments are successful or not might only matter if this can actually have an impact on whether people choose to believe as a product of those arguments or not. But it does not seem that this is really the case. Even if you think that the ontological argument is really good and can hold up, this might still not mean that you then actually come to believe it. So this is, I mean, basically the conception of faith, and this is what we're saying, like truly believing versus making a bet in the case of Pascal's wager, are kind of ethically, morally, maybe religiously distinct, right?
Yeah.
And to be fair, I'm just going to say my personal opinion. I'm not personally particularly religious. Which is why I find the conception of God quite interesting. Both like, you know, arguments around should you believe, does it exist, etc. But then also a lot of political and moral arguments about it as a concept and its effects on society. I find faith interesting because it's quite a double-edged sword. Like on the one hand, I kind of understand that like the point is believing in something without evidence. But then, you know, take that argument out of a religious context and it sounds ridiculous, right?
Yeah, it really does.
Normally we base our beliefs on evidence or some reasonable understanding of the why. But the whole challenge of religion is that you're supposed to believe without that.
Ours is not to question why.
Yeah, exactly. Which like, it's both the romantic appeal and also the thing that makes it so utterly uninviting.
Well, it makes it frustrating because I think, and I've seen really interesting debates like Dawkins versus, I forget his name, but there's a big sort of theological scholar at Oxford and they've had really interesting arguments on this. And it does ultimately come down to faith versus reason. And you've got Dawkins basically saying like, you know, tearing down arguments logically.
It's like, here's all the reasons you shouldn't. And then the other person's answer is, I don't use reason.
It's basically like this debate is
this is the interesting thing about like people who do have faith. It's a bit like arguing about morality with a moral nihilist, right? Like your original premise means that it's impossible to have a discussion, right? So if you're arguing, is this right or wrong, and their argument is nothing is right or wrong, there's no further discussion to be had. Unless that person is willing to debate their premise, but the problem is their very premise is that they don't agree with the method of disagreeing with their premise.
Yeah.
Which means you're trapped.
Yeah.
It's a bit like, I don't mean to draw this analogy as a source of offense to people who are religious, but it's a bit like arguing with a conspiracy theorist, right? Because
it really isn't.
Because the logic is, some elements of the logic are circular, right? So any reason to not believe in the conspiracy theory tends to be reinforcing because it's like, well, that's what they want you to think.
Literally right? that, exactly that. It's, I mean, we've joked about the lizard people before on this podcast and you can just sort of point to any evidence that they don't exist or any evidence of ridiculousness. And it's
they would be like, well, that's just evidence that's been created or manufactured in order to stop you believing in this. And then if you hold that premise, they've effectively disarmed the only way of fighting. And so this kind of brings us to Kierkegaard. famous Danish philosopher's conception of faith. It seems to be that basically his conception of faith is beyond reason because it's constructed as individual passion. If faith is deeply personal and a solo project, then it seems that reason and these arguments that we're putting forward can't really impact faith. That's the nature of it, right? This is what we're saying. If you take this view, then no matter how good you think the arguments we just talked about are, it doesn't really matter, right? You have faith or you don't have faith.
What I find interesting, because I definitely remember like religious figures at like my school growing up and stuff talking about like, oh, you know, I found God, I had like a moment of experience. And I think, to be fair, that could just be the kind of moments you experience, like when you're in nature or something, you know,
maybe it's semantically different understanding of a similar experience to what you've had.
Yeah, as in like you have moments of profundity where
I know this, it's there is a term for this.
Yeah,
the sublime.
Thank you, that's exactly it. And I think, you know, anyone is capable of sort of experiencing the sublime in different ways. And I think if you're brought up in a religious paradigm, you're like, whoa, God, was that you?
Yeah, that's your way of understanding.
and that becomes your way of understanding it, exactly. And then that reinforces your faith, because that actually, and what's interesting and what's ironic, I suppose, about that reinforcing your faith is that's evidence.
Yeah.
Which is supposed to be unnecessary for faith, but it's amazing. I think it's probably quite human to want to fall back on evidence, to look for proof. And I mean, that's why we spent an entire episode discussing it. But
okay, it's a quick one.
Yeah.
Because this is the conclusion of part one.
Yes.
Do you believe in the existence of God? Or is that too big a question to publicly
answer? No.
But let's be more specific. On the scale of definitely exists
to definitely doesn't exist,
To definitely doesn't exist, with agnostic in the middle.
Yeah,
with agnostic being, it's not a knowable thing, and I don't feel strongly.
That's a good distinction to make, because actually, I think there's less evidence for God's existence than there is evidence of it. But I think the most rational position to hold is to say you probably can't know.
But to be fair, sometimes I wonder why we have the word agnostic, right? Because I think most atheists hold the position that, like, if there was good evidence that was brought to light, I'd change my mind.
Yeah. It's Russell's teapot, actually, isn't it?
Yeah.
We haven't talked about that here, and that's probably, I don't think it's coming up, so maybe just mention that quickly. Bertrand Russell says famously, imagine a teapot that's sort of floating around the rings of Saturn.
Yes.
And he's like, he could just say that exists. And he's like, no, the burden of proof should be such that if I make a claim like that, that's quite fanciful and I don't really have evidence for it, the burden should be on me to provide evidence that exists. There's no reason for you to believe it.
Yes.
Take my word for it.
So this is a criticism, like, God is a deeply historically, culturally embedded concept, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the problem is that the method of, or the structure of arguments about God too often take a form where people are having to argue with religious establishment as to why God doesn't exist, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the point Bertrand Russell is making is that actually, yeah, the burden should be the other way around. And just because we've inherited cultural artifacts doesn't mean that, or not literal metaphorical artifacts, doesn't mean that that burden is suddenly reversed. Because he gives the analogy of a teapot going around Saturn, and, you know, he says, prove that it's wrong.
Yeah, it should be like, no, prove that it's right. But it's true. And saying you inherited cultural artifacts is actually a really interesting way of formulating it, because, to be honest, that probably is a big explanation. You go back in time, you look at earlier humans, and there must have been so much that was unexplained about the world, and it probably becomes simple or convenient to say, wow, there's something powerful out there, powerful beyond our sort of powers and understanding. And thus the concept of God probably evolves and
it's
sticks
interesting,
around.
Yeah. I think one of the things that's really cool is, like, when you think about the anthropological history of religion, right? There's two really interesting facts that kind of seem counter, right? Mm-hmm. One is that pretty much all societies seem to worship gods, God/gods, right? Which seems to be some sort of argument in the favor of, like, a faithful person would make the argument, like, clearly this is some evidence that there's something out there. An evolutionary or biological or anthropological perspective might be like, okay, no, humans just have this proclivity towards that belief. That doesn't make that belief true. And then, you know, following that second strand, the thing that you might use as evidence against it is, yes, all societies seem to have this proclivity towards believing in God. They simultaneously, you know, all have different gods, and all feel like they're in touch with this being who's teaching them or whatever. And actually, the fact that they all come to different conclusions seems to be evidence that actually there is no objective reality that's communicating with them, because otherwise you would expect everyone to come to similar conclusions.
Why would
a real God be conveying itself differently to different societal groups?
Well, I'm very glad we've ended on an anthropological explanation, because generally they're my favorite.
Yeah. it's so funny when I remember, like I said, I was I think I mentioned before, I was reading a political theory book, and it was so funny in the introduction to read a kind of anthropological, biological perspective on like morality and society, where it was just like, oh yeah, this just seems to be something that like seems to benefit this group of animals.
Yeah.
So they just seem to have a feeling for it.
And morality is cooperation.
Like, exactly. Whereas like we, what's it? We think of it as like this deep, like objective thing that exists outside of people.
Mm.
And then biologists are like, nah, like they just seem to have this drive towards feeling that for some reason. It's probably evolutionary advantageous.
Probably helps them survive.
Yes, yeah, it helps them cooperate.
Because our souls got kicked out of the tribe.
Basically. And so it's so interesting when you think about it anthropologically. Yeah, overall, I'd say I'm quite similar to you. Maybe I probably should have just read, but I don't really understand the significant difference between agnostic and atheistic.
I think atheist just takes a stronger position. Atheism is basically just like, there is no God. It takes a firm position that God doesn't exist, whereas agnostic just sits in the middle and says,
maybe it does. I am an atheist, but I just don't want that to be misunderstood as I wouldn't change my mind given reasonable evidence.
That's possibly how I feel too. I think that's it, right? Like, and agnosticism seems to be therefore a really reasonable position to take because it sounds more open-minded. Atheists seem more sort of finite in the view, but I'm sure there are atheists who would disagree with that or just say, hey, give me good evidence and I change my mind. So, and that's a good place to wrap up. Thank you guys. We'll be back literally next week because we'll release them sequentially week by week with part two, where we're going to look at the good and bad of religion. Has it been net beneficial to society? Cheers.